It was not an accident that the Hawley Smoot Tariff rose to record heights. These were all attempts to stand against a tide which is moving irresistibly towards a greater unity. Similarly, in the field of literature, it was not an accident that Galsworthy and Wells and Shaw, in my own country, denounced the ethics and the social conventions of the middle class, and that on the continent, Freud and Proust and André Gide did the same thing. It was not an accident that the intellectuals of the 30s flirted with communism, the Koestlers and the Spenders in Europe, and I believe I've heard rumours also in the United States. At least I read a book by Alistair Cook the other day which otherwise couldn't be explained, about Alger Hiss. These trends, economic, political and moral, were all part of a struggle and tension which culminated in World War II. But now the 30s are dead. There is an economic, in economics and politics, morals and literature, less in literature, a new hope, born out of a revolution in American policy. I say a revolution, because I went to a little meeting here in Urbana in 1948 when I was here, when a man called Paul Douglas and Adlai Stevenson were having a meeting in a little Methodist church. And I remember putting my 25 cents in the plate, and everybody went out and said, poor mutts, they've had a long day. But somehow or other, and I've got no politics in America, they got elected. In my own country, we've had the same thing. In spite of Winston Churchill's great prestige, in spite of all the war records, somehow or other, this gang of people got together and produced a government which is called the Labour government, 1945-1950. If I could go into that in more detail. Born out of the travail and sickness of Europe's sufferings and the revolution in American policy, there has been born a new hope. Now, there are, to my mind, three major conditions which must be satisfied if some measure of European and Atlantic unity is to be achieved. Firstly, it must appeal to the vital interests of all categories of men and offer a means of cooperating in one great constructive task. Secondly, it must not be the private preserve of any one party or any one nation or any one ideology. It must be a guarantee of the preservation of authentic diversity, whether it's the diversity of the American way of life, or the British way of life, or the French way of life, or the Norwegian. Thirdly, it must be founded upon the traditions that have made Europe and the United States great, and therefore it must permit a renovation of creative activity, which is badly needed, and of prosperity. In other words, there must be an area for capital to invest in again, instead of just aid, aid, aid. Who are we? We are both heirs of two great traditions, Greek and Christian. Freedom of the mind, which is Greek. Love and respect for all men, brotherhood, which is Christian. But as America has taught me, you cannot merely inherit a tradition or transmit a culture. This is especially for Dr. George Dollar. Our task is different, namely to make a good tradition stand up again on two firm legs. Neither Europe nor the United States is a closed culture. From century to century, there has been a creative restlessness which moves the European to question afresh his relations with God, the world, the community, and the state, sometimes called the dissenting or nonconformist tradition, very deep in this country. Similarly, in the United States, the spirit of inquiry and research, rooted in a democratic culture, continues unceasing. Nothing can stop it. But, if I read the Times aright, we both need freshly stated standards of reference to strengthen the internal and domestic political morality of our citizens, to safeguard the individual, the family, the school, the university, the teacher, the writer, the film, the radio, against insidious encroachments both within and without the state. We need in some cases to return to the simple truths learned by men brought up in our tradition. It's a curious but hitherto unmentioned fact that in Britain the most adventurous minds now contributing to modern thought are mainly over 80, if not over 75. And they're mainly educated in the Victorian era, the despised Victorian era. Bertrand Russell, Gilbert Murray, Lord Robert Cecil, Sir Ernest Barker, Norman Angell, Lord Samuel, R.H. Tawney, Lionel Curtis, Winston Churchill, just to mention a few ordinary people. And they have one thing in common. They were all brought up in the liberal tradition. And they all appeal to an audience and advance ideas wider than a national forum. We live, my friends in Illinois, in no ordinary times. We're at a great watershed of history, what sometimes Mr. Churchill calls a climacteric. I think you can only compare it with the period of the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation. In the spring of 1948, a dramatic meeting was called at The Hague, a convention of the free peoples of Europe. And to it came not only parliamentarians and senators, several ex-prime ministers, but men of commerce and learning, eminent jurists, scientists, economists, and philanthropists. Also, representatives of many bona fide international bodies, the Rotarians, women's organizations, and all denominations of Christian church. It was a very great and dramatic meeting. Even John Mason came, poet laureate, and wrote a poem about it. In less than 14 months, we created what is called the Council of Europe, with its committee of ministers and its consultative assembly, now representing 15 nations, including Germany and ERA, who are not allowed to go to Lake Success. And out of six separate sections, we've created one European movement with Winston Churchill, Henri Spaak, Mr. Schumann, and Count Sforza as President d'honneur. I sometimes think, when I go around this country today, during the last 3 months, in the last 3 weeks, in the Middle West, I have seen my friends being asked to, and some of them having to do it, sign checks for the American Friends of the European Federalism, for the Atlantic Federalism, and for the World Federalism. And some of them are getting a little tired of signing the checks. There isn't quite so much money to sign checks with anyone. And I am wondering to myself whether the United States hasn't approached a period which we were approaching in our different way in Europe in 1948. At any rate, I merely mention that. The Assembly of Europe, as it's called, Consultative Assembly, has met twice. First of all, in the University of Strasbourg, where Goethe studied and where Albert Schweitzer played the organ and taught philosophy. And in this last year, in 1950, in a new building, which is now the permanent house of the council. I was speaking to a class this afternoon, and if they won't mind my repeating it, I must tell them just how we arrange the seats. We sit in alphabetical order so that Mr. Churchill, C, comes next to Mr. Dalton, D. And if you know our politics, that creates a slight sort of feel for amusement. And On the other side here, we've got Mr. Saldaris, the Greek Prime Minister, sitting next to Mr. Tsitsimokas, whom he once put in jail for 3 years. I'm only trying to show you that Europe is coming together in its own way. First of all, for the first time in history, the French and the Germans are sitting down at the same table, side by side. And I can tell you, because I've been in this movement from the beginning, that I and others now know the members of Parliament in the European countries just as well as we know the members of Westminster. It's all very well for you. When I was in the Senate the other day, there were some new senators who'd been elected, and I said, "Who's that?" So Mr. Kiefer or Fulbright or somebody would say, "I don't know him very well. I think he comes from Texas, or I think he comes from New Hampshire." But he didn't say, "I don't know what language he speaks," or something like that. He was a friend, so to speak. He may have been a different party, but he was a sufficient social unity for them to be friends. Well, in Europe, that's never happened. You may think it deplorable, but it's never happened. And therefore, we are in a new position with these people sitting in this. I merely mention the fact that they sit in alphabetical order because it's a new arrangement. We do not come as blocks. We don't go as they go to the United Nations at Lake Success. Gadwin Jebb and his boys here, Austin and his boys there. We don't go as Belgians or socialists, as conservatives or British. We go as Europeans. For the first time in history, there is a European Assembly. Strasbourg is now the political forum of Europe, and federalists and functionalists are hammering out measures, some of which I mentioned this afternoon, and which I will not go into in any detail tonight. Meanwhile, the European movement continues its voluntary work. In each of the countries, there is a branch. We have the United Kingdom branch, the French branch, the German branch, Norwegian branch. But the movement is international. It's European. We have meetings, we issue magazines, we've created the first European college at Bruges, where we hope to train some of the administrators and so on for European and other work. At the same time, thanks entirely to the Marshall Plan, which I think no American yet understands what's done, how much the Marshall Plan's done, I don't believe you will ever understand. But if you allow me to say, as a European, that without it, there would probably be communism across Europe today. I don't say that lightly. I say that as a sober reflection. It has, in effect, in 5 years, take my own country. After the war, we were bankrupt, that's all, bankrupt. We'd sold every single investment. Today, thanks to the Marshall Plan, we're not only able to suspend Marshall aid, which both you and we are very grateful, glad to do, both for good reasons. But we have increased our exports not by 50, but by 83% tonight. And we are able, at any rate, to stand on our own legs. And but for the rearmament program, the people would have been having a reasonable cut, not only of the joint, but of life. But I'm afraid it's gone back in the last 6 months, inevitably. 70% of all private trade in Europe has been freed from restrictions, quotas. Currencies have been made partly convertible. Every free election in Europe has registered a strong anti-communist vote. Trade unionists and teachers, with American participation, have shaken off communist elements and formed new federations. Dean Russell will tell you all about, from Columbia, will tell you all about the teachers' angle on that. The intellectuals like Koestler and Saloni and Spender, whom I mentioned just now, and hundreds of others have deserted The God That Failed, if any of you have read that quite interesting book in which they give their testimony. The 30s, I said, are dead. I say it again, the 30s are dead.
were in the 50s and the 60s.
But as an inspiration of loyalty, the cause of European unity, a great conception, is not enough. The cause of the Commonwealth, the great fraternity of people, is not enough. The driving power of the United States with its immense material and moral resources, and I beg of you not to underrate the latter. It's just as important for you to give to Europe a good agricultural extension scheme as it is refrigerators, if I may put it in a single sentence, and a host of other things that you have to do. Patriotism and love of mother country, an eternal inspiration for all art, is not enough. To confront the expansive imperialism of Russia with its unity of command and its chain of discipline. One fundamental reality, which the events of the last 5 years have made clear beyond a doubt, is the interdependence of Western Europe and North America. Compelling mutual interests have set in train during the last 3 years since martial law, the most momentous development of a century. The growth of an organic Atlantic community with the beginnings of a common defense system, permanent organs of economic cooperation, and the beginnings, alas, only embryonic, of a common foreign policy. Some people talk of a bridge across the Atlantic. The analogy is not correct. We are attempting to build a community, and you cannot build a community, an effective community, except around one center. The Atlantic community has a clear and undisputed center of strength. That is the United States.